This is the question and answer
session. This is the question and answer session, so ask or answer something.
My question is this. All the information that you presented is highly relevant and of real interest, but it did not reflect, for me at any rate, the unique role of China in the world capitalist economy. In other words, what difference is China's presence and its evolution as a capitalist power going to have in the evolution of the rest of the capitalist world? Or will it not make any difference?
What I did was that in this talk, I intentionally shortened the part about China, and partly because I do not want to repeat what I already said in my book, and partly because I try to take into account the latest development of the global capitalist crisis, and as far as China's role, and maybe I did not emphasize this enough in my talk. But first of all, it's essential for the triumph of global capitalism. Because of the, without the failure of the Chinese Revolution, the global capitalist class would not have the political initiative back to the 1970s. And then without China's massive cheap labor force, there would not be the probably there would not be the necessary economic condition that would be required for the global capitalist class to undermine the global working class bargaining power, to revive the global profit rate. So these things would not have happened. And so that's important for China's counter-revolution and then incorporation into the global capitalist market. It's essential for the global neoliberal project. And on the other hand, China also, the Chinese capitalists also play the, as I explained earlier, this very important function in deepening the global capitalist class, capitalist crisis. And on the one hand, by directly contributing to the current crisis, China has been a major part of these so-called global financial imbalances. So China's trade surplus, the American trade deficits, that's the global financial imbalance, in which is important background of the current global capitalist crisis. On the other hand, potentially, more significantly, by contributing to global environmental crisis, accelerating climate change, and that has a major impact on the possible shape of the future of the world. Yes?
I read a number of your stuff, and I have tons of questions, so I'm only going to limit it to two. My first question has a lot to do, has to do with your transformation in prison, and particularly someone who, at one hand, believed in 1989 that China, and most particularly the China, the democracy movement, and the Chinese Communist, there were some problems in the Chinese Communist Party. And that you had more of a liberal kind of perspective. How is it that you were able to move from there to a Maoist perspective in China when there had been so much criticism, critique, and for all those of us in the U.S. have very little information other than, you know, Hampton and others who have produced stuff on it, particularly on the Great Cultural Revolution. And my second question has to do with China. You mentioned in terms of because of China cheap labor, but Africa has a lot of cheap labor. And how? What? In addition to the cheap labor, what is it that what made China most unique? Is it its capacity to control this cheap labor? Is it the capacity to created a capitalist class. So I'm quite interested in both of those two questions.
regarding your second part of the question, and address that first. Cheap labor, of course, is important, but of course, by itself, it's not enough. To have variable capital accumulation, you need not only cheap labor force, you also need infrastructure, you also need the engineers, intellectuals, and the most importantly, a variable state. I think I have not studied Africa enough, but I think what happens to Africa is that over the past century, several centuries, it has been so much exploited by the global capitalism, of course, in particular Western capitalism. So, and now, under the burden of severe exploitation for so many centuries, it could no longer sustain variable state structures in much of Africa. And so in that kind of conditions, and to some extent that also happens to Middle East. And so we do not have the basic conditions for variable capital accumulation. Well, in the Chinese case, China was of course incorporated into the capitalist world system in 19th century, which in turn resulted in the collapse of the traditional Chinese empire, but it has also led to major transformation of China's social structure, therefore created the conditions for Chinese revolution. And with that, by the 1950s, a new state structure was created, which provided the political conditions for capital accumulation. And then ironically, it also prepared the necessary industrial, technological, social conditions for the later capitalist development in China. And so that placed China in a relatively favorable way when in the 1980s, China was again deepened its interaction with the global capitalist market. Well, regarding the first part of your question, maybe the best way is to read the preface of my book. And at this point, I would just say that I was just one among many students and intellectuals in China at the time. I was probably among the earliest that turned from the believer into free market capitalism into a leftist, socialist, and Marxist Maoist position. And the story is basically, to some extent, similar to in other circumstances. If you try to explain intellectual trend, try to explain people's thinking, ideology, you have to place that into the historical context. And so what happened in the 1980s was that given the historical circumstances, there was a general tendency for free market capitalist ideology to dominate among the Chinese intellectuals. And that happened actually not only in China, also in other former socialist states. In Eastern Europe, in former USSR, there was a general tendency for the intellectuals to be dominated by the neoliberal ideologies. And it's only at a later point when the contradictions of neoliberal capitalism again became apparent on the one hand, and on the other hand, when some of the intellectuals and all urban middle class themselves, it turns out themselves failed to benefit from capitalist transition. Some of them in turn actually became proletarianized. The combination of these social tendencies again created the condition for the revival of leftist ideas among intellectuals in the former socialist states. And in fact, the left intellectual trend since then has grown increasingly stronger in China. Now has got growing influence among young intellectuals and young students. If you look at the internet, look at the debate on the website, in many cases, the leftist ideas could even be said to have the upper hand compared to the right-wing neoliberal ideas.
I think it's very important that you point out the the huge problems that are presented by apparent global warming, and of course you're aware of this, but you pointed out mostly the relationship between global warming and CO2. But you know, there's a lot of talk too, as the tundra melts, there'll be lots of methane release, which is per unit is 20 times. That's the thing that's even
newer development. Right, right. Yeah.
And so that's a real trend. Another thing, I think it's also very important to point out the importance of having this gigantic mobilizable reserve army in China, which I understand is, you know, it can't just keep increasing. I mean, for many years they've had a one-child policy. You know, in 20 or 30 years, you'll have one child taking care of one
China's
or two parents. And
actually is aging even more rapidly than the U.S. Yeah.
And even more rapidly than Japan, perhaps. I don't know.
But Japan is already in very advanced stage of aging. Yeah.
But the point is, you're not going to have that reserve army is really not going to be there for that long.
Right.
So, you know, if the capitalists want to produce, they're going to have to make use of the workers here. I mean, what's stunning to me, and I, you know, this is a personal thing, but I'm doing another version of this book I did in 78 called Death on the Job, and it has to do with working conditions and occupational health and safety. You know, I started out in St. Louis and Chicago in 69, 72, 73, working, you know, helping organize grassroots groups, COSH groups, committees on safety and health. And we had a huge industrial plant, but in St. Louis, in Chicago, you know, the Southworks was still going. We had a huge International Harvester, Local 6 out in Stone Park. There was a big Ford plant. All the steel industry has basically disappeared. You know, the auto industry has disappeared. I talked to people from Chicago, you know, there's a bunch of Mexicans working and assembling toys and plastics. There's a lot of financial stuff going on. And so all those jobs have been exported, along with the toll on the working class has been exported to China, to India. They have tens of thousands of deaths in the coal mines in China, for example. And so this is what I suppose I'll have to write about. That's why the kinds of things you're writing about and talking about is very important to the sort of things I'm just thinking about, and maybe hopefully writing about too.
Yeah, I think
you
are correct in pointing out that China's this cheap labor force will not be there forever. And certainly one day the Chinese workers will not just be content with these sweatshop conditions, and they will demand at least 8-hour working day. But the Chinese capitalism will not be able to afford to offer 8-hour working day. The current condition is that on the one hand, you have this expansion of the working class in China. On the other hand, this new working class that is currently employed in the capital sector, although potentially they are going to develop this struggle and become an effective political force, at the moment their level of organization, their level of political consciousness remain underdeveloped. But on the other hand, we also have got a historical working class that used to work in the state sector, but in the time of privatization have become laid off, and this part of all the working class has developed a comparatively high level of class consciousness, and in many ways even socialist consciousness. And so one possible strategy or advantage for the future Chinese working class movement would be to have this unity, solidarity between the old working class, and that had developed this socialist consciousness, if that could in turn be used to influence the new working class, and that could become a potentially powerful combination of working class struggle. And then, of course, in this time of global capitalism, that will also have impact on the conditions of class struggle in this country. If with the development of the class struggle of the Chinese working class, and one day the American capitalism will no longer be able to benefit from the cheap labor from China, right? So American capitalism will no longer be able to benefit from the manufactured goods manufactured by this Asian cheap labor. And then American capitalism will also no longer benefit from cheap oil. Right? And then on top of that, the current strategy of Obama administration to deal with the economic crisis will have the consequence to leave the trillions of dollars of debt for the American government. So in the future, it will also face an escalating fiscal crisis. And then you also have energy and the environmental crisis in general. So the combination of these forces, I think, will lead to it will be the contradiction that American capitalism will not be able to overcome, and it will lead to conditions that point to radical transformations. And how exactly this transformation will take place in this country, I don't know. But the existing structure of capitalism will not be able to sustain itself, given the weight of all of these contradictions.
And then in China, right, in 76. You talk about the Cultural Revolution in 76?
No. The Cultural Revolution from 66 to
76. So the ending of the Cultural Revolution,
right,
was the kind of revolution,
right, right,
by the Deng Xiaoping faction, I suppose.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, in United States, American leftists, many American leftists,
uh-huh,
criticize the Cultural Revolution. Much so, okay, as a disaster.
Uh-huh.
Now you presented in your book a very positive,
uh-huh,
you know, project of,
uh-huh,
the Cultural Revolution. For instance,
right,
they trained the doctors,
uh-huh,
in 3 years from 6 years, in order to,
uh-huh,
to provide for the major,
right,
population. You also talk about how he tried to revolutionize the party, and by going to the party itself, but he couldn't do it, so he went to the peasant, the student, and the workers. That's how the Great Cultural Revolution started. I just wonder, what is your sense of why is the American leftist so critical of the Cultural Revolution?
They
really
come down on the Cultural Revolution.
It's
a disaster.
Yeah. My understanding is correct. Back to the early 1970s, virtually all the American leftists, not only the progressive left, but also liberal left, and to some extent even the mainstream, were quite enthusiastic about the Chinese Cultural Revolution. And then after 1976, when the Chinese official line changed, and then the Western mainstream opinion also changed. Then large sections of the left, but I guess especially liberal left, also changed their view about China, about Mao Zedong, about the Cultural Revolution. That's a part of the global neoliberal ideology in the 1980s was to discredit the historical socialism, not only the Soviet model, but also the Chinese Maoist model. And by discrediting the historical socialism, that in turn paved the way for the ideology there's no alternative but free market capitalism. And just like at the time, as I said, it affected the Chinese intellectuals, the intellectuals in the former historical socialist states, and it was also a time when many former radicals and who were active in the 1960s, and after they observed these setbacks and they became disillusioned about the possibility of revolutionary transformation. And so I think it all took place within this broad context.
The other question is, could you find in the empire's militarism into this current system? He's saying that, well, U.S. hegemony is coming down, declining. But how does militarism factor in to protect U.S. interests?
Well, basically, I think the military adventure under Bush administration represented a gamble by the American capitalist class to revive the American hegemony. That gamble, in effect, failed. It failed to achieve its main strategic objective. Under
control of the oil and Iraq,
controlling of oil, right,
East,
right.
Obama is
Fighting a war with potentially less strategic benefit, but with potential even more catastrophic consequences. So it's
you refer to Afghanistan or?
Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yeah,
right. Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah. And in terms of the American military force, of course, for a long time to come, America will still to have the world's most massive force of destruction, for sure. But the problem is that it could no longer use it to, in a constructive way, to advance its own hegemonic power. And also, it's limited by two factors. Why is that? It's limited by the limited military manpower that U.S. could mobilize. And then secondly, limited by the long-term tendency of nuclear proliferation in the rest of the world. So given these circumstances, that actually increase another degree of unpredictability about how the world is going to evolve in the future. And so it's going to further destabilize global capitalism for sure, but on the other hand, it also increased the it also raised the question, just like global environmental crisis, and about what's going to be the future world that's going to replace capitalism. Yes.
At the end of your essay.
I just thought I'd inject this. This wasn't really in the main part of your what you were talking about at all, but as something I'm aware of, and I've read some things about it from time to time. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund were they were established after World War II, and they were established by the developed countries that had won the war, and the colonies. I mean, an awful lot of the world was like colonies or very undeveloped. They had no voice in that, and one of the things that these institutions do is they make it so they, well, if a country needs to make a loan to survive or something like that, they have to live by rules like they will not do anything to develop their own infrastructure, their education, their health policy, their own economy internally. They have to sacrifice all of the things, all of the social network that they would normally have. And it's something built into the world structure, which is very destructive to developing the world as a whole, and especially the developing countries. And I would suspect that China would be right involved with the developing countries also. So I just thought I'd ask for your comments on that. I know the big issue right now is global warming, and it's already here, and we're likely to go extinct from, because I don't know if the people are going to agree to these things. I think they'd rather would go extinct, but that's part of the question. Just comment on like the World Bank and the IMF.
Well, that's a good example about how the hegemonic power historically has interacted with the interstate competition. And so when the hegemonic power is well functioning, its power is at its peak, it could effectively regulate the system. And in the case IMF or World Bank, then through certain international organizations, actually immediately after World War II, even United Nations was an institution which the US could use to regulate the system. And so right after World War II, and you have these Bretton Woods, so-called Bretton Woods institutions that were created, and which reflected the US hegemony, especially the US financial industrial hegemony at the time, and which was used to promote, to manage the international monetary system, but also to promote schemes like Marshall Plan that contributed to the revival of the global economy. So here you have a classical example when the hegemonic power was functioning well. It not only promoted its interests of national capitalism, but it also simultaneously it advanced the interests of the global capitalist system as a whole. That's right after World War II. And then in the 1980s, 1990s, then IMF, World Bank again play important role in this case in imposing structural adjustment program or monetarism on the rest of the world. But here, on the surface, it seems the US hegemonic power was still strong. So it could use these institutions to advance its own interests. But here the story had already become very different from the post-1945 period. That is, after the 1970s, in the 1970s, it's very obvious the US hegemonic power was in relative decline after the defeat in Vietnam War. And the collapse, actually the collapse of the Bretton Woods monetary system. And so in that context, of course, under Reagan administration, there has been this attempt to revive the US hegemony. And the neoliberalism was a part of this strategy. But in this case, the attempt to revive the US hegemony had devastating consequences on the rest of the world. And so what seems to contribute to the revival of the US hegemony, in the meantime, destabilized the entire system, right? And which of course was not sustainable. And now we are in yet another stage, that is, the decline of the US hegemony had become apparent, irreversible, and pretty much recognized by everyone. And then on the other hand, no other big power is really in a way to replace the US. And so these institutions, especially about IMF, has basically become directionless. And they could no longer function as effective institution in any way.
Yes. Just about some details about, the collapse of the dollar worldwide in the next decade, that would be a really huge, that's a really big deal. I mean, that'll, you know, have a tremendous effect on the world economy and change politics and change a lot of things. But just on the details of like how that would play out, the current system, even though, as you point out, it is, you know, big, it's very unstable because, you know, you have big surplus pluses and big deficits on the other side. At the same time, the system, it manages to hold itself together because nobody, it seems, or everybody would be hurt by the collapse of the dollar. So for example, if for the United States, the collapse of the dollar, of course, is a catastrophe. Also for China, all these dollar reserves that they have, you know, if the dollar collapses, then all of a sudden they're holding all this paper. And that holds true for, all the, people, institutions in the world that hold dollars. So, you know, nobody would really want to see that happen, even though there are these pressures. So, what is it that, you know, will really? Who's going to turn away? How is it going to break? I mean, it seems like because of this, everyone has an interest in keeping the dollar alive, or so many people do, or it seems. How will it come about, do you think?
Well, first of all, I would agree that the U.S. dollar right now is still essential ingredient of this stability of the global capitalist economy. Therefore, the collapse of the dollar, of course, would be hugely destabilizing. And for that reason, of course, not only the U.S., but to some extent, the capitalist classes in other countries, especially like in places like China, would try to postpone the collapse of dollars as long as possible. But the conditions will develop to the point where the capitalist classes, for example, Chinese capitalism, could no longer defend the dollars. That is because, and on the one hand, in the future, we are going to have the decline of the global oil production, and so the peak oil will become apparent. So in a few years, we could again face rising energy costs and related to that, rising food costs. And so that could create global inflationary pressure. And under the conditions of global inflationary pressure, the dollar could become the weakest link, given that over the past years, the U.S. Has accumulated massive amount of foreign debt. And so the U.S. dollar position has become increasingly weaker, especially now in comparison to the Chinese renminbi, the Chinese currency. And so in that kind of condition, if we have a global inflation pressure, dollar will be under pressure. On top of that, to deal with the current crisis, in response to the current crisis, the Federal Reserve has dramatically increased the money supply. And also, there has been a massive expansion of the U.S. government debt. Now, under the current crisis, ironically, the massive increase of money and debt would not result in an immediate danger of the U.S. dollar. And partly because under the current crisis, there will be a, this is somehow getting technical. Under the current crisis, there is a tendency for the private investors to abandon every other risky type of financial assets. And then the government-backed money or debt would consider to be relatively safe. However, if there's in the future, there's global inflationary pressure, and then in that kind of conditions, and that would no longer be the case. Then in that case, the massive amount of money and the government debt and could add on to this inflationary pressure. Then in addition to that, in addition to the increase of government money and the debt as a result of current crisis, the U.S. and other advanced capitalist countries would also face long-term structural crisis, partly because of the previous outcome of class struggle, and which are reflected in the historical entitlements of healthcare and government-provided pensions. That, in combination with the demographic trends, and will result in increasingly more serious fiscal crisis. And then a fourth reason I can think of, that is, since the 1980s, the U.S. economic structure has changed to the point that it has basically been dominated by the financial capital. So that today, the U.S. not only depends on the rest of the world for raw materials, for energy, it also depends on pretty much all of the manufactured goods. And so unless there's a major restructuring of the U.S. industrial structure, and this kind of dependence cannot be changed, it's just a matter of time, it will eventually translate into a currency crisis. And because ultimately, there's no reason for the rest of the world just to hold the paper dollar forever, and which is pretty clear that there's no possibility this paper dollar could be translated into real goods that corresponds to the same value. It's not promising. Yeah. Yeah.
Semi-periphery and the periphery nations. I was wondering if you could just kind of lay out briefly where you see the trend of in Latin America the pushback against neoliberalism in Venezuela, Brazil, and Ecuador in terms of where they were before the pushback and where those nations are now currently.
Since about 2000, Latin America has become one of the forefront of the global anti-neoliberal struggle, anti-imperialist struggle, and with a number of left-leaning governments, but especially with the tendency towards revolution in Venezuela and Bolivia. But my own understanding is that it seems, of course, everything is still developing, but it seems the class struggle in places like Venezuela and in the rest of Latin America by now has reached the stalemate. That is, in other words, it's unlikely for the revolution forces to make decisive breakthrough in the short run. It's difficult to say what are the exact reasons. But apparently, in places in like Venezuela, Chavez has failed to effectively mobilize the working class, especially the urban and the rural poor. And so, except for voting, there's no effective political organization, the means of production mostly are still in the hands of the capitalist class. The media is still in the hands of the capitalist class. So the real state power, to a large extent, at best, is being shared between the bourgeoisie and the progressives. And there's no sign, moreover, that the revolutionary forces is gaining force. So that a few years ago that was disguised by the oil boom, and so with the oil revenue and so Chavez could pursue the social programs. So that is of course somewhat worrying. But on the other hand, I don't see that Latin America is going back to neoliberalism either. And that is because neoliberalism has done so much damage, and so that I guess even the urban middle class would hesitate to support a return to neoliberalism. So it's a stalemate of class struggle. So that is in the short run. But in the medium and the long run, I think with the deepening of the global capitalist classes, class struggle will continue to develop everywhere. And I don't know exactly and where it's going to be the major breakthrough place. Maybe in South Asia, maybe in China. But generally speaking, the entire semi-periphery area, in this case including Eastern Europe, including Russia, including Latin America, China, India, could potentially be the decisive battleground of class struggle. Maybe even more decisive than the West in determining the future of the world. And that is because this will be the area that include the majority of the world population. This will be the area that include most of the was economy, industrial production. And in the neoliberal era, this semi-peripheral economy generally had depending on one way or the other, exports to the advanced capitalist countries as the model of capital accumulation. But now with this crisis of neoliberalism, we are going to enter into a period of deglobalization, and therefore that's going to undermine the model of export-oriented, export-based capital accumulation. In the neoliberal era, in places like China, this is also the place where the new large industrial working class has taken shape. And potentially, that's also going to be the places where in the future the working class struggle would be concentrated. And moreover, these are the semi-periphery is also the places that has either relied upon energy intensive, pollution intensive industrial development, or alternatively, depends on the exports of energy or commodities. And so with the global energy and environmental crisis, this could also be the area that's going to be hit most severely by the energy, global energy and environmental crisis. And so this is likely to be a places where you have all of these contradictions converging together, therefore potentially the weakest link of global capitalism.
I'm just standing up stretching, but talking to my friends in Brazil, in both the labor movement, as well in sort of medium-sized towns in the state of Bahia, what I sense is an increasing amount of chaos, just violence in the street. Everybody, you know, in a town I used to live in, I was in the Peace Corps in the 60s, no one ever thought of being mugged in Vitória da Conquista, a town of 150,000, which is kind of a regional capital. Now, you know, my friends who, you know, are middle class, they're mugged. They're mugged in their cars in São Paulo. The industrial working class is declining. I have a good friend who's a union leader in Osasco. In the early 80s, they had 40, 50,000 members of the metal workers union in Osasco. Now it's down to 25, 30,000. I mean, it's deindustrializing, or at least the nut, because the capitalists are becoming more efficient. I've heard even in China, with the, you know, with they're importing a lot of new technologies, in some cases even robots, and the actual number of Chinese industrial workers has been falling in the last several years, even as production goes up 10, 15% a year. Can you comment on that? I mean, these people are surplus people, just like a lot of the African-American population in the U.S., in Brazil, the Afro-Brazilian population. People say, oh, you don't want to come in and work your ass off? We'll bring in what Richard Pryor used to call the new, well, anyway, you remember that line.
Well, I guess the first comment I would have is that in China, yes, you have this, China now is like a capitalist paradise, and you have this massive increase of wealth, luxuries on the part of a capitalist class. But now the class contradiction in China has developed a point that it not only created these many sweatshops, not only destroyed the traditional working class, it also started to undermine the interests of urban middle class, or petty bourgeoisie, basically. And so now even the petty bourgeoisie could not afford buying houses. The university students, when they graduate, they find themselves unemployed. Like each year, China has now has 5 to 6 million college graduates unemployed. And so their middle class dream was destroyed, you know. And
but they're selling more cars every month than they do in the United States now.
Well, it's the right, you are selling cars, but you know, in China, you have this basically growing polarization, you know, the social class that can afford to buy cars become narrower and narrower. Now, another comment would be that another side of this, your comment about this rising machine to labor ratio, capital to labor ratio, of course, is this massive increase in the use of electricity, energy, etc., right, and which deepens the environmental crisis. That's the. Yeah.
One question I was curious to ask. In the 70s during the Cultural Revolution, he was able to get a lot of information coming out of China. At that time, it was called Peking Review and a number of different stuff. Where can we go to get a sense of the left in China in terms of what's happening, what's going on in terms of the working class, the intellectual thought? Is there some place on the website? Is there some place?
Many websites. This is many library discussion on the internet. Many leftist websites. So I guess you have to first study Chinese.
But other than that, there's a new book by a person. It's called Mo Bo Gao. Mo Bo Gao. Okay, last name G-A-O. G-A-O, Gao. And he teaches in Australia. And he has new book also by the Pluto Press. It's called Battle with China's Past.
What with China's Past?
Battle with China's. An excellent book which covers all of this intellectual debate between the right wing, left wing, about Mao Zedong, about the Cultural Revolution, and about Zhong Chang's book. So it's all about the, you know, there this Dr. Li, the book, you know, with who claimed to be the Mao's private doctor, you know, he had all of this powerful criticism about these mainstream ideas, and so that's just a wonderful book, and you know, so definitely want to look at.